Good morning, I'm Ruth, I'm one of the pastors here. Today, of course, is Palm Sunday when we reflect on Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. It's also week 6 in our Lenten series looking at the 7 I Am statements in John. And today we'll be focusing on the last of those statements, I am the true vine. The Gospel of John is interesting in that it's not like the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke. It's not trying to present a chronological account of Jesus' life. Often the writer of John will put events in a different order or even leave out some major events to structure his gospel in a very clear way. As we've been looking at in the series, he has these 7 I am statements which present Jesus' own claims about who he is. You can see those on this slide here. I am the bread of life, I am the light of the world, the gate, the good shepherd, the way, the truth and the life, the resurrection and the life, and the true vine. And in addition, John's gospel has 7 signs. Changing water into wine at Cana, healing the royal official's son at Capernaum, healing the paralytic at Bethesda, feeding the 5,000, walking on water, healing the man born blind, and raising Lazarus from the dead. Each of these signs obviously includes a miracle, but they also show us something about who Jesus is. And they're included in John's gospel for a reason. And the writer gives that reason towards the end of his gospel in chapter 20. We read, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So the whole purpose of the 7 signs and the 7 I am statements and the events being laid out in the order that he gives them is so that we might have life through believing in Jesus. Now, obviously, we're all alive, but John is talking about having true life, real, meaningful life, which, according to one of the I Am statements, is actually Jesus himself. And next week, Easter Sunday, we'll look at Jesus' statement, I am the resurrection and the life. And that statement, I'm the resurrection and the life, was said at the raising of Lazarus from the dead, which was the last of the 7 signs. And that event was immediately followed by Jesus' entry into Jerusalem, which we celebrate today on Palm Sunday. We read, the next day the great crowd had come for the festival, heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. They took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel. Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it, as it is written, Do not be afraid, daughter Zion. See, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt. At first, his disciples did not understand all this. Only after Jesus was glorified did they realize that these things had been written about him and that these things had been done to him. Now, the crowd that was with him when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to spread the word. Many people, because they had heard that he had performed this sign, went out to meet him. So the Pharisees said to one another, See, this is getting us nowhere. Look how the whole world has gone after him. So, had these 7 signs and the others that are not recorded in John's Gospel achieved their purpose in leading people to life through believing in Jesus? Well, we can see from this story that there were crowds. Crowds not of just good religious folk, but all kinds of people. We know from other passages that these crowds included people who weren't thought much of at the time. Women, poor people, foreigners, children, people who were considered sinners. The religious leaders here say the whole world has gone after him. And that seems to be said with a certain degree of contempt. The people following Jesus included any old riffraff. And these crowds were saying the kind of things that suggested that they believed. They were shouting, Hosanna, which means save us. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel. But the writer of John's Gospel goes on to say that people didn't really believe. And those that did thought it was not worth the cost, or it was too risky. We read later in chapter 12. Even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. Yet at the same time, many even among the leaders believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they would not openly acknowledge their faith for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue, for they loved human praise more than praise from God. And this has actually been the pattern throughout the Gospel of John. You might remember in week 2 of the series, we looked at the sign of Jesus feeding the 5,000, followed by that first I am statement, I am the bread of life. And in that story too, huge crowds followed Jesus, but many left when he didn't give them more bread. And most of those who did believe said Jesus' message was too hard, it was too costly, and they left too. So now we come to Palm Sunday and we see the crowds again. But we know this is soon followed by Good Friday, when we have another crowd but with a very different response to Jesus. And the writer of John says Jesus was aware of this dynamic. He knew that the crowds gathered and sometimes said the right thing, but they didn't really believe. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we have the well-known story of Jesus clearing the temple after his arrival in Jerusalem on a donkey. You might remember that story. He overturns the tables of the money changers, chases out the market stall owners, people who were exploiting the poor and were making it all but impossible for Gentiles, for non-Jewish people, to pray in the temple. In John, we find that same story at the beginning of his gospel account at an earlier Passover. John apparently places it there to set the scene from the outset of growing conflict between Jesus and the religious leaders. And at the end of John's account of the clearing of the temple, he writes, "While Jesus was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing and believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person." I think this is a really sad verse. Jesus knew what people were like. He knew that even though they're cheering, they're giving him acclaim, they seem to be saying the right things, they didn't really believe. They were likely to desert him or to reject him. And so John is writing for subsequent generations. His desire is that through thoughtful consideration of the signs and the claims and the carefully arranged events, we will see what most people at the time missed. We will find true life through believing, through truly believing. And we'll see what John means by truly believing as we look at the I Am statement for today. As we've seen in other weeks in this series, in these I Am statements, Jesus reinterprets and appropriates some of the most treasured imagery in the Jewish culture. So Jesus says he's the true manna and the true bread of the presence. He's God's provision for everyone who's hungry. He's the light of the world. The prophets say that Israel is called to be the light to the world, the light to the nations. But Jesus takes that concept out of the nationalistic context and says he is the light of the world. And we, his followers, including foreigners, the poor, the sinners, and the other riffraff, we are the light of the world. Last week we saw that Jesus said he's the good shepherd. He is the true protector and guide of everyone, rather than the exclusive nationalistic and religious leaders. We didn't look at the statement, "I am the way, the truth, and the life" in this series, but there Jesus is saying, "I am the true law, the true Torah. I'm giving you a new way to live, a new way to think about life." And then in this last statement, "I am the true vine," Jesus takes up the metaphor of a vineyard, which is used throughout Jewish scripture to describe the intimate relationship between God and Israel. Vineyards were hugely important in ancient Israel. Wine was seen as a sign of God's blessing, and failed grape harvests were viewed as evidence of God's displeasure. Wine played an important cultural role in religious and social events, and it was considered to have various medicinal properties in addition to it being a regular drink. Vines were treasured and nurtured and valued, and because they were so precious, it's perhaps not surprising that the imagery of vines and vineyards was used metaphorically. They were celebrated in poetry, they were associated with romance, and they're used in the Jewish scriptures to speak of God's love for Israel. In the Psalms, Israel is pictured as being God's treasured vine. We read, "You transplanted a vine from Egypt. You drove out the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground for it, and it took root and filled the land." Similarly, in several of the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Hosea, Ezekiel, and others, Israel is presented as a vineyard owned and cared for by God. Perhaps the most famous of these passages is the Song of the Vineyard, in Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah was writing towards the end of the 8th century and beginning of the 7th century BCE, when Jewish society had undergone quite a rapid transformation. It had become more centralized, the government had expanded, and standing armies had been formed, and taxation had been increased to pay for these armies and all these government institutions, and smaller farmers, finding themselves unable to pay the taxes, were forced to sell their lands. Under Jewish law, they shouldn't have had to. The land should have been protected, but it seems it wasn't. And so Israel saw the growth of a social elite class profiting from international trade, which blossomed at this time, and land grabbing. And in that context, Isaiah writes this: "I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it with stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I'll tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. So this is a song sung by the prophet Isaiah, a friend of the vineyard owner. Isaiah tells of the love and care that God had bestowed on the vineyard Israel. God prepared the land, dug terraces, removed the rocks, built a watchtower to provide protection from thieves, built a wine press. God had provided everything, done everything necessary to ensure a good harvest. The sole purpose of the vineyard was to bear fruit, but Israel failed to do that. Instead of good fruit, God found worthless grapes, bad fruit, as it's translated in this version. And using wordplay, Isaiah says, God looked for justice, mishpot, but saw bloodshed, mispok. Sought righteousness, tzedakah, but instead heard cries of distress, tsa'aka. Remember, Isaiah is speaking primarily against the social elite, the land-grabbing merchants who were oppressing the poor. In fact, shortly before the Song of the Vineyard, Isaiah writes this: the Lord enters into judgment against the elders and leaders of his people. It is you who have ruined my vineyard. The plunder from the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor? Declares the Lord Almighty. So this is very vivid imagery. It's the poor who are being crushed like grapes. The leaders and the elders are supposedly good religious people, but they're not. They're thieves, they're oppressors, they exploit the vulnerability of the people that they're entrusted with leading. And so Isaiah prophesies that God will progressively remove divine protection and provision. First, God will take away the hedge that was to keep out the wild animals. Then God will break down the wall that kept out the thieves. Then God will stop pruning and cultivating and leave the vine to its own resources, so to speak. The vine won't disappear, but briars and thorns will grow there. It will become indistinguishable from the surrounding areas, a wasteland, back to what it was before God stepped in and created the vineyard. And then finally, seemingly as a last resort, God will even withhold the rain. Isaiah said this was a love song. It's not an angry song of judgment and vengeance, but a song of grief and heartbreak. What more could God have done for Israel? And it's a prophetic psalm. It's a warning to take note and change before all this comes about. And yet, for all this prophecy of being trampled and becoming a wasteland, Isaiah didn't give up hope. He also prophesied about a future time when the vineyard would become fruitful. We read in chapter 27. In that day, sing about a fruitful vineyard. I, the Lord, watch over it. I water it continually. I guard it day and night so that no one may harm it. I am not angry. If only there were briars and thorns confronting me, I would march against them in battle. I would set them all on fire. Or else let them come to me for refuge. Let them make peace with me. Yes, let them make peace with me. In days to come, Jacob will take root. Israel will bud and blossom and fill all the world with fruit. This is a promise of abundant fruitfulness. Fruitfulness that's incredibly inclusive. One where even the briars and thorns, the enemies of the vine, are invited to make peace. This is a promise to fill all the world with fruit. A beautiful hope for the future. We know from the Synoptic Gospels that Jesus picked up on this metaphor through his parables. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke's account of Palm Sunday, after riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, Jesus cleared out the temple, which we looked at earlier, infuriating the religious leaders. And then he returned the next day, sat down, and started teaching in the temple courts as if nothing had happened. So as you might imagine, the religious leaders were furious, and they asked Jesus, by what authority are you doing this? In other words, who do you think you are coming in here as if you own the place? And Jesus responded by retelling Isaiah's Song of the Vineyard, but putting quite a different spin on it. Let's read that in Matthew's account. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. When the harvest time approached, he sent his servants to the tenants to collect his fruit. The tenants seized his servants. They beat one, killed another, and stoned a third. Then he sent other servants to them, more than the first time, and the tenants treated them the same way. Last of all, he sent his son to them. "They will respect my son," he said. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to one another, "This is the heir. Come on, let's kill him and take his inheritance." So they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to these tenants? "He will bring those wretches to a wretched end," they replied, "and he will rent the vineyard to other tenants who will give him a share of the crop at harvest time." I have a feeling they responded too quickly there before thinking it through, because a few verses later on we read, "When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard Jesus' parables, they knew he was talking about them. They looked for a way to arrest him, but they were afraid of the crowd because the people held that he was a prophet." So they asked Jesus, who does he think he is? And his response is first to point out who they are. They are the wicked tenants. They're the leaders, the ones God has entrusted with the vineyard. They're supposed to tend and care for the vine. And in this version of the parable, the vine is not the problem. The vine is producing fruit. It's the tenants. They act as though it all belongs to them, as if they own the place. And they beat and kill the servants sent to them by an incredibly patient vineyard owner. By contrast, Jesus is not a tenant or a servant, but the vineyard owner's son. He's the heir. The vineyard does belong to him. And yet he knows the tenants have every intention of killing him too. John's Gospel doesn't have any parables in it, so we don't read this story there. But of course it does have these seven I am statements, figures of speech that use sacred Jewish imagery. And in John's Gospel, shortly before his arrest, Jesus picks up on this vine imagery. And he uses it to say not just that he's the son of the vineyard owner, as in the parable, but that there is a much more intimate connection between God and humanity. Jesus is not only the Son of God, the Son of the Father, he's also the true vine. Let's read that in John's Gospel. "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine grower. He removes every branch in me that bears no fruit. Every branch that bears fruit, he prunes to make it bear more fruit. You have already been cleansed by the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me as I abide in you. Just as the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Those who abide in me and I in them bear much fruit, because apart from me you can do nothing. Whoever does not abide in me is thrown away like a branch and withers. Such branches are gathered, thrown into the fire and burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask for whatever you wish and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit and become my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you." There is so much we could say about this passage, but I just want to focus on three aspects: the invitation to abide, the expectation of pruning, and the promise of fruitfulness. So first, the invitation to abide, or to remain, as some versions translate it. This is something that's repeated like a refrain in this passage. 5 times Jesus says, "Abide in me." 3 times, "I abide in you." 2 times, "Abide in my love." Plus, "I abide in the Father's house." "Abide in the vine." "My words abide in you." Abide is meno in the Greek, and it means to stay or remain, or to dwell or reside. There's a sense of permanence about it, of being at home. And John really likes this word. He uses it about 40 times in his gospel, compared to a total of 12 times in the other 3 gospels. In fact, in the previous chapter, Jesus says, "In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you?" Dwelling places here is the same word, meno. It's a place to abide or to remain. Jesus says he's going to prepare a place where we can abide, where we can be deeply at home with God. And a few verses later, we see that word again. Jesus says, "I will ask the Father, and he will give you another advocate to be with you forever. This is the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him. You know him because he abides with you, and he will be in you." So within these two chapters, we've got lots of abiding going on, lots of mutual indwelling. Jesus says, "Abide in me as I abide in you. Abide in my love as I abide in the Father's love. I'm preparing a place for you to abide in the Father's house, and I'm sending the Spirit to abide in you." And in John 15, we get all this mutual abiding or indwelling presented in terms of a vine. Jesus is a true vine, and we are the branches, intimately connected. We're tended and cared for by the Father, and the Spirit of Jesus flows through us, leading us to fruitfulness. Jesus says we continue to abide in him, to be intimately connected to the Father and to the Spirit by obeying Jesus' commandment to love one another. In past series, we've looked at the idea of perichoresis, which is just a fancy word for the mutual indwelling of the persons of God, the Father, Son, and Spirit being in dynamic community with one another and being one with each other. And sometimes this is pictured as a dance of love. And in this passage in John, Jesus is inviting us into this dance to join with God in loving one another and loving the world. The picture of God standing at a distance, brokenheartedly judging the vine that we saw in Isaiah's Song of the Vineyard is replaced here by a picture of God in Jesus becoming the vine, becoming one with humanity and inviting humanity to remain one with God through the power of love. Second, the expectation of pruning. Most of us probably don't have too much experience with pruning grapevines, but perhaps we have rose bushes or other plants or trees that we have to cut back. Because that's what pruning is, of course. It's cutting back to stop wasted growth and to redirect the plant's energy and resources. When we prune a plant, we remove diseased or broken branches that can't recover. We cut out dead branches that are just taking up space. We also cut out inward-growing branches that rub against each other and cause wounds. And we even often have to get rid of some good branches that are simply too many of them, so that we get rid of some so that the remaining branches can thrive without becoming overwhelmed. Pruning is a sign of care. Speaking more specifically of pruning grapes, a vineyard worker from Northern California said this: "New branches have a natural tendency to trail down and grow along the ground, but they don't bear fruit down there. When branches grow along the ground, the leaves get coated in dust. When it rains, they get muddy and mildewed. The branch becomes sick and useless. We don't throw it away or cut it off. It's much too valuable. We go through the vineyard with a bucket of water, looking for those branches. We lift them up and wash them off." Pruning, tying back, lifting and washing off, this all takes time and effort to ensure the health of the vine. But the vine growers say it's worth it because the vine is valuable. The branches of the vine are valuable. In John 15, Jesus says, "The Father removes every branch in me that bears no fruit, and every branch that bears fruit, he prunes to bear more fruit." The word used there that's translated removes, the Father removes every branch that bears no fruit, literally means lifts up. It often means lift up to take away, but it literally means lifts up. And I think that's interesting given the quote given by the vineyard worker that we just read. But Jesus says that when we are unconnected from him and from his love, we wither and become useless. He doesn't seem to be saying we'll be punished if we don't remain in his love, so much as stating these are the consequences. We will become unfruitful. We will become dry and brittle. We need to abide in Jesus to remain healthy and fruitful. So what might pruning mean for us? I think it's a metaphor we could use in a lot of different ways. But firstly, I think it reminds us that Jesus never promised an easy life. He never said, "Come and follow me and everything will go well for you. You'll have no problems." Being pruned, cutting out the unhealthy parts of our life, learning to let go of the things that hurt us and hurt others can be a hard and painful process. Letting go of our false self, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, letting go of our pride and our need to have our own way, allowing God to shape us can be an uncomfortable or even a painful journey. And we're unlikely to see immediate results. Pruning can actually feel like we're going backwards. You know, we're getting rid of all this lovely green growth. But if it's not productive growth, we may need to get rid of it. There are an endless variety of activities and habits and attitudes and even relationships that we may need to cut back to become more fruitful. And that can be hard. Following Jesus can be hard. That's what the crowds discovered. That's why so many of them turned away. It seemed too hard, too costly. But the result of pruning is, of course, a healthier and more fruitful plant. And the wonderful thing about this mutual indwelling that we've been looking at, the abiding in God, is that God is in us, joined to us, is one with us as we struggle through this pruning process. We're not alone in this. And then third and finally, we have the promise of fruitfulness. In Isaiah's Song of the Vineyard, the fruit God looked for was justice and righteousness. In Paul's letter to the Galatians, he describes fruit as love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, fruitfulness, and self-control. And gentleness, always forget one. Fruit is all of these things, and it's more. Fruit is what comes naturally from abiding in Jesus. It's not what we determine to achieve. It's what simply grows out of being in that dance of love. The 19th century pastor and author Andrew Murray wrote, "The essential idea of fruit is that it is the silent, natural, restful produce of our inner life." Fruit grows when we stay connected to Jesus, when we abide in him through prayer and worship and mindfulness and other spiritual practices, and through obedience to his commandment to love one another. If we abide in Jesus, then we can stop striving to be better and we can trust God with the outcomes, trust God to make that fruit grow. And that's actually hard for some of us. Some of us are very aware of our shortcomings. We want to be more loving, joyful, peaceful, patient, kind, and so on. And when we fail, we perhaps beat ourselves up about it or become very discouraged. I know I do that sometimes. Jesus says, "Abide in me, spend time with me, draw close to me, join the dance of love, and fruit will grow. Without you having to worry and strive, it will grow naturally." As we close out this part of the service, let's look at the three reflection prompts that we've been using for the series. He is. What does this say about Jesus? Well, I think in this passage, Jesus presents us with a beautiful picture of who he is. He's one with us. He's in us. We're in him. He abides in the love of the Father and is fruitful, not by striving or stressing, but by remaining in love. And he invites us into this intimate connection, into this dance of love. Second, I will be. What does this say about who we hope to become? John 15 says, "I will be fruitful if I abide in Jesus, if I choose the way of love. I don't need to worry about becoming someone or making a name for myself or even becoming a better person. If I abide in Jesus, I will bear fruit. I will become part of that fruitfulness that fills the whole world that Isaiah prophesied about." And then I will. What can I say or do now to move towards who Jesus is and who I am becoming? For me, I know one challenge is to be still and to make time simply to be with Jesus. I find that there's always so much to do, good things, useful things, but possibly some of it is unproductive greenery that needs pruning to make more space and time to simply be with Jesus. We're going to take communion now. As we do, I want to leave you with a contrasting image of two types of branches. One is a palm branch that the crowds cut and waved on Palm Sunday. Palm branches are big and showy. They're easy to cut and to wave enthusiastically. But when the crowds dropped those branches to the ground, they would have quickly dried up and withered. The other kind of branch is a vine branch. These are the ones on our farm. They're wrapped tightly around the support. They're using the support to hold the weight of the fruit. And although the green leaves disappear each winter, these branches hold on tenaciously. They're still very much alive, being deeply rooted. May we be branches that remain on the vine, that are deeply rooted in Jesus, and may we find true life through abiding in Jesus. Let's take communion together.